15. Death lay heavily in the chill night darkness. In the gloom ahead of them, a great corroded organism was dying. Cracked and broken, the crumpled shape painfully oozed body fluids onto the curb and sidewalk. Around it, a growing pool of shiny moisture formed, expanding and bubbling. For a moment, Hamilton failed to identify it. The shape quivered slightly as it settled onto one side. Starlight pulsed weakly from its shattered windows. Like rotten wood, the bulging hull of the car sagged and collapsed. Even as he watched, the hood split open like an egg. Rusting parts dribbled from it and lay spread out, half submerged in the puddle of oil, water, gasoline, and brake fluid. Momentarily, a flicker of solidity played through the car's massive frame. Then, with a protesting groan, the remains of the engine settled down through the corroded supports and onto the pavement. The motor block broke in half and began a slow, methodical collapse into confused, blunted particles.
"Well," Hillingford's driver said, resigned, "there goes that."
Glumly, Hillingford gazed at the wreck that had been his Cadillac. Gradually, infuriated outrage crept visibly through him.
"Everything's collapsing," he said.
Viciously, he gave the remains of the car a kick. The Cadillac settled further into a shapeless blob of metal that faded off into the night shadows.
"That won't do any good,"
one of his men pointed out.
"Might as well leave it alone."
"We're going to have trouble getting back to the plant,"
Hillingford said, shaking ugly drops of oil from his trouser cuff.
"There's a working-class district separating us."
"They may have the highway barricaded,"
his driver agreed. In the semi-gloom, the company toughs were indistinguishable from one another. To Hamilton, each was a vague, heavy-set Germanic giant, brutal-faced and emotionless.
"How many men do we have here?"
Hillingford demanded.
30,
the answer came.
"Better light a flare,"
another company tough suggested, without particular conviction.
"It's too dark to see them when they start moving."
Shouldering his way to Dr. Hillingford, Hamilton said harshly,
"Is this all serious? Do you people really believe?"
He broke off as a brick crashed against the remains of the Cadillac. Off in the gathering shadows, dim shapes raced and crouched.
"I see,"
he said, filled with dread, and with comprehension.
"Oh, my God," Marcia said thinly. "How can we live through it?"
"Maybe we won't," Hamilton answered.
A second brick came singing through the darkness. With a shudder of fright, Marcia ducked and made her way to Hamilton.
"It almost hit me. We're right in the middle. They're going to kill each other right here."
"Too bad it didn't hit you,"
Edith Pritchett said quietly.
"Then we'd be out of this."
Aghast, Marcia gave a little despairing cry. Around her, the hard, unsympathetic faces of the group were stark white in the uncompromising flicker of the company flare.
"You all believe it. You think I'm a communist?"
Hillingford turned quickly. An almost hysterical terror appeared on his brutal, corrupt face.
"That's right, I forgot. You were all out on a party picnic."
Hamilton started to deny it. Then weariness overcame him. What did it matter? Probably, in this world, they had been out on a communist picnic, a progressive rally with folk dances, songs of loyalist Spain, slogans and speeches and petitions.
"Well," he said mildly to his wife, "we've come a long way, through three worlds to get here."
"What do you mean?"
Marcia faltered.
"I wish you had told me."
Her eyes blazed.
"Don't you believe me either?"
In the darkness, her slim, pale hand flashed upward. A stinging pain burst against his face and shattered around him in a blinding turmoil of sparks. Then, almost immediately, the resentment drained out of her.
"It's not true,"
she said hopelessly. Rubbing his swollen, burning cheek, Hamilton said,
"It's interesting, though. We were saying we wouldn't know until we could get into people's minds. Well, here we are. We were in Sylvester's mind. We were in Edith Pritchett's mind. We were in Miss Rice's insane mind."
"If we kill her,"
Sylvester said evenly,
"we'll be out of here."
"Back in our own world," McFaith said.
"Keep away from her," Hamilton warned them. "Keep your hands off my wife." Around them stood the tight, hostile circle of the group. For a time, none of them moved. The six figures were stiff with tension, arms rigid at their sides. Then Laws shrugged and relaxed. Turning his back, he walked slowly off.
"Forget it," he said over his shoulder.
"Let Jack take care of her. She's his problem."
Marcia began breathing in rapid, shallow gasps.
"This is so damn awful. I don't understand it."
Miserably, she shook her head.
It just doesn't make sense.
More stones had fallen around them. In the eddying shadows, sounds were audible, faint and rhythmic, swelling until they had become drifting chants. Killingford, his heavy features cruel and bitter, stood listening.
"Hear them?" he said to Hamilton. "They're out there, hiding in the darkness."
His coarse face twisted in a spasm of loathing.
"Beasts."
"Doctor,"
Hamilton protested,
"you can't believe this. You must know this isn't you."
Without looking at him, Killingford said,
"Go join your red friends out there."
"Is that the situation?"
"You're a communist,"
Killingford said tonelessly.
"Your wife's a communist. You're human debris. You have no place at my plant, no place in decent human society. Get out and stay out."
After a moment, he added,
"Go back to your communist picnic."
"Are you going to fight it out?" Hamilton asked him.
"Naturally."
"You're actually going to start shooting? You're going to kill those men out there?"
"If we don't,"
Killingford said logically,
"they'll kill us. That's the way it is. It's not my fault."
"This stuff can't last,"
Law said disgustedly to Hamilton.
"They're dummy actors in a cheap communist play. This is a shoddy parody, Life in America. You can damn near see the real world showing through."
A burst of staccato gunfire broke out wildly. On the roofs of nearby houses, workmen had silently mounted a machine gun. Puffs of luminous gray cement dust billowed up as the line of bullets rattled closer. Killingford dropped awkwardly down on his hands and knees behind the ruin of his Cadillac. His own men, squatting and running, began to fire back. A hand grenade was tossed through the darkness. Hamilton hunched over, rocking with the concussion as a column of exploding flame leaped searingly into his eyes and face. When the fury had settled, a deep pit lay spread out, half filled with littered rubble. Several of Killingford's henchmen were visible among the debris, their bodies distorted into impossible postures. As Hamilton dully watched their broken struggles, Laws said in his ear,
"Do they look familiar? Look close."
In the billowing darkness, Hamilton could not make out the sight with clarity, but one of the shattered, inert figures had a familiar appearance. Baffled, he stared down at it. Who was the person stretched out among the littered ruin, half buried by sections of torn-up pavement and still smoldering chunks of ash?
"It's you,"
Laws said softly. So it was. The dim outlines of the real world wavered and ebbed, visible behind this distorted fantasy, as if even the creator of the scene around them had developed certain fundamental doubts. The rubble-littered pavement was not the street, it was the floor of the Bevatron. Here and there lay other familiar figures. Stirring faintly, they were beginning to creep back to life. Among the smoking ruins, a few technicians and medical workers inched cautiously forward. They picked their way with care, moving with agonizing slowness, step by step, careful not to expose themselves. Descending from nearby houses to ground level, they dropped stealthily to the gutted street. Or was it a street? Now it seemed more like the walls of the Bevatron, and the safety catwalks leading to the floor, and the red armbands of the workmen seemed more like Red Cross armbands. Confused, Hamilton gave up trying to unscramble the montage of places, shapes.
"It won't be long,"
Miss Rice said quietly. With the breakup of her world, she had reemerged, exactly as before, in her long corduroy coat, wearing her usual horn-rimmed glasses and clutching her precious purse.
"This particular conspiracy isn't very successful, not nearly so well constructed as the last."
"You found the last one convincing?" Hamilton inquired icily.
"Oh, yes. At first I was almost taken in. I thought..."
Miss Rice smiled with fanatical intensity.
"So very clever, really. I almost believed it was my world. But of course, when I stared into the lobby of my apartment building, I realized the truth. When I found the usual threatening letters on the hall table..."
Shivering and kneeling down beside her husband, Marcia said,
"What's wrong with it? Everything seems so hazy."
"It's almost over,"
Miss Rice said remotely. In an ecstasy of hope, Marcia clutched convulsively at her husband.
"Is it? Are we going to wake up?"
"Maybe," Hamilton answered. "Some say so."
"That's wonderful."
"Is it?"
Panic fluttered across her face.
"Of course it is. I hate this place. I can't stand it. It's so bizarre, so mean and dreadful."
"We'll talk about it later."
His attention was fixed on Killingford. The ponderous capitalist boss had assembled his gang of men and was talking with them in low, measured tones.
"These goons,"
Laws said softly,
"are by no means done. Before we're out of here, we're going to see a fight."
Killingford had finished his discussion. Jerking his thumb toward Laws, he said,
"String him up. That's one out of the way."
Laws grinned starkly.
"Another nigger about to be lynched. The capitalists do it all the time."
Incredulous, Hamilton almost laughed out loud. But Killingford meant it. He was in deadly earnest.
"Doctor,"
Hamilton said thickly,
"this only exists because Marcia believes in it. You, all this fighting, this whole demented fantasy. She's already letting it fall apart. It's not real, it's her illusion. Listen to me."
"And that red,"
Killingford said wearily. He mopped his bloody, grimy forehead with a silk handkerchief.
"And his red floozy. Douse them with gasoline when they're through kicking. I wish we'd stayed at the plant. We were safe there for a while, at least. And we could have set up a better formula of defense."
Like ghostly shadows, the workmen were creeping through the rubble. More grenades exploded. The air was heavy with indistinct bits of ash and fragments of debris that rained silently down.
"Look,"
David Pritchett said, awed. Across the dark night sky, huge letters were forming. Hazy, uncertain, luminous blurs that gradually burgeoned themselves into words. Already partially disintegrated slogans of comfort, written shakily across the black emptiness for their benefit.
"We are coming. Hold out. Fighters of peace, arise."
"Very comforting," Hamilton said, revolted. In the darkness, the dull chanting had risen in pitch. The cold wind swirled phrases of shouted song to the half-concealed group.
"Maybe they'll save us yet," Mrs. Pritchett said uncertainly. "But those awful words up there, they make me feel so strange."
Here and there, Killingford's men moved, gathering rubble, collecting odds and ends, building up fortified positions. Almost lost in the swirling clouds of mist and smoke, they were only dimly visible. Now and then a harsh, bony face was illuminated, rising momentarily into sight and then sinking back into the nebulous gloom. Who did they remind him of? Hamilton tried to think. The pulled-down hat, the beaked noses.
"Gangsters,"
Laws reminded him.
"Chicago gangsters of the 30s.
Hamilton nodded.
"That's it. Everything according to the book. She must have memorized it perfectly."
"Leave her alone," Hamilton told him without much conviction.
"What comes next?"
Laws said ironically to the huddled shape of Marcia Hamilton.
"The capitalist bandits become crazed with desperation. Is that it?"
"They look desperate already,"
Arthur Sylvester commented in his somber way.
"Such unpleasant-looking men," Mrs. Pritchett fluttered apprehensively. "I didn't realize such men existed."
At that moment, one of the fiery slogans in the sky exploded. Bits of flaming word cascaded down, setting the heaps of rubble on fire. Cursing, beating at his clothing, Killingford reluctantly retreated. A section of burning rubbish had fallen on him, setting his coat on fire. To his right, his group of company toughs were half-buried under a vast, incandescent outline portrait of Bulganyan that had come loose from the sky and fallen directly on top of them.
"Buried alive,"
Laws said with satisfaction.
More words were falling now.
A gigantic sizzling piece had landed on Hamilton's tidy little house. The roof was ablaze, as well as the garage and clothesline. Wretchedly, he watched it flare up brilliantly and send flickering tongues of flame high into the night. There was no responding wail of sirens from the dark town. The streets and houses lay stretched silently out, closed and hostile to the incineration.
"Good Lord,"
Marcia said fearfully.
"I think that big coexistence is coming loose."
Crouched with his men, Killingford had lost control of the situation.
"Bombs and bullets,"
he was repeating, over and over again, in a low, monotonous voice. Only a few of his gang of toughs survived.
"Bombs and bullets won't stop them. They're starting to march."
In the flickering darkness, a line of shapes was moving forward. The singing chant had risen to an orgy of feverish excitement. Dark and harsh, it swelled out, preceding the stern men making their way through the burning piles of rubble.
"Come on,"
Hamilton said. Grabbing his wife's limp hand, he led her swiftly off into the settling chaos around them. Finding his way by instinctive memory, Hamilton led his wife around the side of their burning house, along the cement path and into the backyard. A section of fence had charred through and disintegrated. Pulling Marcia along, he shoved his way among the smoking fragments and into the dark yard beyond. The houses were opaque forms that loomed ominously. Now and then, a transient vision of running men appeared ahead, faceless, interchangeable workmen quietly making their way to the scene of the fighting. Gradually, the shapes and the sound of gunfire died. The sputter of flames receded. They were out of the immediate battle.
Wait!
Laws and McFaith appeared behind them, panting for breath.
Tillingford has gone berserk!
Laws gasped.
God, it's a mess!
I can't believe it,
McFaith muttered, his thick face shiny and contorted.
They're down on all fours, matted with filth and blood, fighting like animals.
Ahead of them, lights winked and glowed.
What's that?
Laws demanded suspiciously.
We better keep off the main drag.
It was the business section of Belmont that lay spread out, but not as they remembered it.
Well,
Hamilton said acidly, we should have expected it. It was a sprawling slum that winked and glowed in the night darkness. Seedy, slatternly shops rose up like unwholesome mushrooms, ugly and blatant. Bars, pool halls, bowling alleys, houses of prostitution, gunshops. And over everything came a metallic screech, the blaring din of American jazz projected by speaker horns mounted over tawdry pinball arcades. Neon signs flashed and winked. Armed soldiers wandered aimlessly, picking over the stale choices in this crumbling expanse of moral depravity. In a store window, Hamilton saw a strange sight. Rows of knives and guns displayed in plush cases.
Why not?
Law said.
The communist idea of America. Gangster cities full of vice and crime.
And the rural areas,
Marcia said gravely.
Indians, wild killings and lynchings. Bandits, massacres, bloodshed.
You seem pretty well informed,
Law observed. Dejected, despairing, Marcia sank down on the curb.
I can't go any farther,
she informed them. The three men stood awkwardly, not knowing what to do.
Come on,
Hamilton told her roughly.
You'll freeze.
Marcia said nothing. Shivering, she hunched over, face down, arms clasped together, body small and frail against the cold.
We better get her inside,
Laws said.
Maybe one of these restaurants.
There's no point in going on,
Marcia said to her husband.
Is there?
I suppose not,
he answered simply.
You don't care if we get back?
No.
Is there anything I can say?
Hamilton, standing behind her, indicated the world around them.
I can see it. That's about all there is.
I'm sorry,
McFaith said clumsily.
It's not your fault,
Hamilton answered.
But I feel responsible.
Forget it.
Bending down, Hamilton placed his hand on his wife's trembling shoulder.
Let's go, honey. You can't stay here.
Even if there's no other place to go?
That's right.
Even if there's no other place to go. Even if we've reached the end of the world.
Which you have,
Laws commented brutally. Hamilton had no answer. Crouching down, he pulled his wife firmly to her feet. Listlessly, she permitted him to drag her up. In the cold and darkness, she was an unimposing collection of matter that followed obediently after him.
It seems like a long time ago,
Hamilton reflected, holding on to her hand.
That day I met you in the lounge and told you Colonel T.E. Edwards wanted me.
Marcia nodded.
The day we visited the Bevatron.
Just think,
McFaith said harshly.
If you hadn't visited it, you wouldn't have found out.
The restaurants were too lavish, too ostentatious. Uniformed servants bowed and scraped, rat-like obsequious men who scuttled about among the ornate tables. Hamilton and his group roamed aimlessly, with no particular destination in mind. The sidewalks were almost deserted. Now and then a ragged shape pushed past them, a bent-over figure hunched against the wind.
A yacht,
Laws said spiritlessly.
What?
A yacht.
Laws nodded toward a block-long illuminated display window.
Lots of them. Want to buy one?
In other windows, expensive furs and jewelry were displayed, perfumes, imported foods, and the eternal Rococo restaurants with their bowing servants and luxurious hangings. Occasional clusters of ragged men and women stood gazing in without the means to buy. Once, moving glumly along the street, came a horse-drawn cart. In the back of the cart, a dull-eyed family sat clutching its lump of belongings.
Refugees,
Laws conjectured.
From drought-starved Kansas. From the Dust Bowl, remember?
Ahead of them stretched the vast red light district.
Well,
Hamilton said presently,
what do you say?
What have we got to lose?
Laws agreed.
We've gone as far as we can. There's nothing left.
We might as well enjoy ourselves,
McFaith muttered,
while we still can, before this unholy ruin breaks down completely.
Wordlessly, the four of them made their way toward the mass of glaring neon lights, fear signs, flaring horns, and flapping tattered awnings, toward the old familiar safe harbor. Weary and grateful, Marcia sank down at a table in the corner.
"It feels good," she commented. "Nice and warm."
Hamilton stood absorbing the dim friendliness of the room, the bedraggled comfortableness of the heaped ashtrays, the collections of exhausted beer bottles, the tinny jangle of the jukebox. Safe Harbor hadn't changed. At the bar sat the usual group of workmen, vacant-faced shapes hunched moodily over their beers. The wooden floor was littered with cigarette butts. The bartender, languidly wiping the surface of the bar with his dirty rag, nodded to McFaith as the three of them seated themselves around Marcia.
"Good to get off my feet," McFaith sighed.
"Everybody want beer?"
Laws asked. They signified their assent, and he wandered off to the bar.
"We've come a long way,"
Marcia said wanly, slipping out of her coat.
"I don't believe I've ever been here before."
"Probably not," Hamilton agreed.
"Is this a place you come to?"
"This is where we all used to go for beer, when I was working for Colonel Edwards."
"Oh,"
Marcia said.
"I remember now. You used to mention it."
Carrying four bottles of Golden Glow beer, Laws appeared and cautiously seated himself.
"Help yourselves,"
he told them. "You notice something?" Hamilton said, as he sipped his beer.
"Look at the kids."
Here and there, in the dim recesses of the bar, were teenagers. Fascinated, he watched a young girl, certainly no older than 14, make her way to the bar. That was new. He didn't recall that. In the real world, it seemed a long way behind them. And yet this communist fantasy wavered around him, insubstantial and hazy. The bar, the rows of bottles and glasses, extended into an indistinct blur. The drinking youth, the tables, the litter of beer bottles, faded off into cloudy darkness. He couldn't locate the rear of the room. The familiar red neon signs reading men and women were not visible. Squinting, he shaded his eyes and peered. A long way off, past the tables and drinkers, was a nondescript streak of red light. Was that the signs?
"What does that read?"
he asked Laws, pointing. Lips moving, Laws said,
"It looks like emergency exit."
After a moment, he added,
"It's up on the wall of the Bevatron, in case there's a fire."
"It looks more like men and women to me," McFaith said. "That's what it always said before."
"Habit,"
Hamilton told him.
"Why are those kids drinking?"
Laws asked.
"And taking dope. Look at them. They've got weed there, sure as hell."
"Coca-Cola, dope, liquor, sex," Hamilton said. "The moral depravity of the system. They probably work in uranium mines."
Couldn't erase the bitterness from his voice.
"And they'll grow up to be gangsters and carry sawed-off shotguns."
"Chicago gangsters,"
Laws amplified.
"Then into the army to slaughter peasants and burn their huts. That's the kind of system we have. That's the kind of country this is. Breeding ground for killers and exploiters."
Turning to his wife, he said,
"Right, honey? The kids taking dope, capitalists with blood on their hands, starving bums scavenging through garbage cans."
"Here comes a friend of yours,"
Marcia said quietly.
"Of mine."
Surprised, Hamilton turned dubiously around in his chair. Hurrying through the shadows toward them came a slim, willowy blonde, lips breathlessly apart, hair tumbled over her shoulders. At first he didn't recognize her. She wore a drawstring blouse, low-cut and rumpled. Her face glowed with layers of makeup. Her tight skirt was slit almost to her thighs. She had on no stockings, and her bare feet were thrust into untidy, low-heeled loafers. Her breasts were immense. As she came up to the table, a cloud of perfume and warmth drifted around him. A complicated mixture of scents that brought back equally complicated memories.
"Hello,"
Silky said in a low, husky voice. Bending over him, she briefly touched her lips to his temple.
"I was waiting for you."
Rising, Hamilton offered her a chair.
"Sit down."
"Thanks."
Seating herself, Silky glanced around the table.
"Hello, Mrs. Hamilton,"
she said to Marcia.
"Hello, Charlie. Hello, Mr. Laws. May I ask you one question?"
Marcia said curtly.
"Certainly. What size bra do you wear?"
Without self-consciousness, Silky slipped down her blouse until her magnificent breasts were visible.
"Does that answer your question?"
she asked. She wore no bra. Flushing, Marcia retreated.
Yes, thanks.
Gazing with unabashed awe at the girl's distended, almost mystically upraised bosom, Hamilton said, I guess the bra is a capitalist trick designed to deceive the masses.
Talk about masses,
Marcia said half-heartedly, but the sight had robbed her of any real spirit.
You must have trouble finding things you've dropped, she said to Silky. In a communist society,
Laws announced,
the proletariat never drops anything.
Silky smiled absently. Touching her breasts with her long, tapering fingers, she sat for a time deep in thought. Then, with a shrug, she lifted her blouse around her, smoothed down her sleeves, and folded her hands on the table.
What's new?
Big battle over our way, Hamilton said. Blood-sucking vampire of Wall Street versus heroic, clear-eyed, joyfully singing workmen. Silky eyed him uncertainly.
Who seems to be winning?
Well, Hamilton conceded, the lying fascist jackal pack is pretty much buried in flaming slogans.
Look,
Law said suddenly, pointing.
See that over there?
In the corner of the bar stood the cigarette dispensing machine.
Remember that?
Laws asked Hamilton.
I sure do.
And there's the other one.
Laws pointed to the candy dispensing machine in the opposite corner of the bar, almost lost in the drifting shadows.
Remember what we did to that?
I remember.
We had that thing spouting top-quality French brandy.
We were going to change society,
Laws said.
We were going to alter the world. Think what we could have done, Jack.
I'm thinking.
We could have turned out everything anybody ever wanted. Food, medicine, whiskey, comic books, plows, contraceptives. What a principle that was.
The principle of divine regurgitation. The law of miraculous fission, Hamilton nodded. That would have worked out fine in this particular world.
We could have outdone the party,
Laws agreed.
They have to build the dams and heavy industries. All we needed was a you-know bar.
And a length of neon tubing, Hamilton reminded him. Yes, it would have been a lot of fun.
You sound so sad,
Silky said.
What's wrong?
Nothing, Hamilton answered shortly.
Nothing at all.
Is there anything I can do?
No.
He grinned a little.
Thanks anyhow.
We could go upstairs and go to bed.
Willingly, she stroked aside the fabric that covered her loins.
I always wanted you to have me.
Hamilton patted her wrist.
You're a good girl, but that won't help.
You're sure?
Appealingly, she showed him her bare, moistly luminous thighs.
It'll make us both feel better. You'd enjoy it.
Maybe once, but not now.
Isn't this a sweet little conversation?
Marcia murmured, her face pinched and drawn.
We were just kidding, Hamilton told her gently. No harm intended.
Death to monopolistic capitalism,
Laws interjected with a solemn belch.
All power to the working class,
Hamilton responded dutifully.
For a people's democracy of the United States,
Laws stated.
For a Soviet of socialistic Americas.
Around the dim bar, a few of the workmen had looked up from their beers.
Keep your voice down,
McFaith warned uneasily.
Hear, hear,
Laws cried, banging on the table with his pocket knife. Opening the knife, he laid it out menacingly.
I'm going to skin one of the carrion eaters of Wall Street,
he explained. Hamilton studied him suspiciously.
Negroes don't carry pocket knives. That's a bourgeois stereotype.
I do,
Laws said flatly.
Then, Hamilton decided, you're not a Negro. You're a crypto-Negro who's betrayed his religious group.
Religious group?
Laws echoed, hypnotized.
The concept race is a fascistic concept,
Hamilton confided.
The Negro is a religious and cultural group, nothing more.
I'll be damned,
Laws said, impressed.
Say, this stuff isn't bad at all. Would you like to dance?
Silky said to Hamilton, with sudden intensity.
I wish I could do something for you. There's such an awful despair about you.
I'll recover, he told her briefly.
What can we do for the revolution?
Laws demanded eagerly.
Who do we kill?
It doesn't matter,
Hamilton said.
Anybody you see. Anybody who can read and write.
Silky and some of the attentive workmen exchanged glances.
Jack,
Silky said in a worried voice,
this isn't a joking matter.
Absolutely not, Hamilton agreed. We were almost lynched by that mad dog of monopolistic finance, Tillingford.
Let's liquidate Tillingford,
Laws cried.
I'll do it, Hamilton said. I'll dissolve him and pour him down the drain.
It seems so funny to hear you talk this way,
Silky said, eyes still fixed doubtfully on him.
Please, Jack, don't talk this way. It scares me.
Scares you? Why?
Because...
She gestured hesitantly.
I think you're being sarcastic.
Marcia gave a thin, frantic bark of hysteria.
Oh, God, not her, too.
Some of the workmen had slid from their stools. Edging their way among the tables, they were approaching quietly. The noise of the bar had faded away. The jukebox was deathly still. In the rear, the teenagers had slipped away into the eddying gloom.
Jack,
Silky said apprehensively.
Be careful, for my sake.
Now I've seen everything, Hamilton said. You, politically active. You, an honest, home-loving girl, is that it? Corrupted by the system?
By capitalist gold,
Claus said moodily, rubbing his dark forehead and upturning his empty beer bottle.
Seduced by a bloated entrepreneur, a minister probably, has her maidenhead mounted on the wall of his library over the fireplace.
Gazing around the room, Marcia said,
This isn't really a bar, is it? It just looks like a bar.
It's a bar in front, Hamilton pointed out. What more do you want?
Put him back,
Marcia said unsteadily.
It's a communist cell, and this girl here... You work for Guy Tillingford, don't you?
Silky said to Hamilton.
I picked you up there that day.
That's right, but Tillingford fired me. Colonel T.E. Edwards fired me, Tillingford fired me. And I guess we're not done yet.
With vague interest, Hamilton noticed that the circle of workmen around them were armed. In this world, everybody was armed. Everybody was on one side or the other. Even Silky.
Silky, he said aloud, is this the same person I used to know?
For a moment, the girl faltered.
Of course, but...
She shook her head uncertainly. Tides of blonde hair spilled down around her shoulders.
Everything's so darn mixed up. I can hardly keep it straight.
Yeah, Hamilton agreed. It has been a mess.
I thought we were friends,
Silky said unhappily.
I thought we were on the same side.
We are, Hamilton said. Or were one. Somewhere else, in some other place. A long way from here.
But didn't you want to exploit me?
My dear, he said sadly, I have eternally wanted to exploit you. Throughout time, in all lands and places, in all worlds, everywhere, I'll want to exploit you until the day I die. I would like to take hold of you and exploit you until that titanic chest of yours rattles like an aspen in the wind.
I thought so,
Silky said brokenly. For an interval, she leaned against him, her cheek resting against his necktie. Clumsily, he toyed with a strand of blonde hair that had fallen across her eye.
I wish,
she said distantly,
that things had worked out better.
So do I, Hamilton said. Maybe I could drop by and have a drink with you once in a while.
Colored water,
Silky said.
That's all it is. And the bartender gives me one chip.
A little sheepishly, the circle of workmen had drawn their rifles out.
Now?
One of them asked. Disengaging herself, Silky got to her feet.
I suppose,
she murmured, almost inaudibly.
Go ahead. Get it over with.
Death to the fascist dogs,
Laws said hollowly.
Death to the wicked, Hamilton added. Can we stand up?
Certainly,
Silky said.
Whatever you want. I wish... I'm sorry, Jack, I really am. But you're not with us, are you?
Afraid not,
Hamilton agreed, almost good-humoredly.
You're against us?
I must be, he admitted. I can't very well be anything else. Isn't that so?
Are we just going to let them murder us?
Marcia protested.
They're your friends, McFaith said in a sick, defeated voice. Do something, say something. Can't you reason with them?
It wouldn't do any good, Hamilton said. They don't reason. Turning to his wife, he gently raised her to her feet.
Close your eyes, he told her, and relax, it won't hurt much.
What are you going to do?
Marcia whispered.
I'm going to get us out of here, by the only method that seems to work.
As the circle of rifles clicked and lifted around him, Hamilton drew back his fist, took careful aim, and hit his wife cleanly on the jaw. With a faint shiver, Marcia collapsed in Bill Laws' arms. Hamilton took hold of her limp body and stood foolishly clutching her. Foolishly, because the dispassionate workmen were still very tangible and real as they loaded and adjusted their guns.
"My God,"
Laws said wonderingly.
"They're still here. We're not back at the Bevatron."
Stunned, he helped Hamilton support his inert, totally unconscious wife.
"This isn't Marcia's world after all."